In addition to an elephant made of apples, $1 million of gold dust, and the world's largest display of clams, what else might we have seen at Seattle's 1909 World's Fair?
Wow. Where to begin? The World's Fair in 1909 in Seattle, I was most drawn to the ethnographic exhibits, which is a very fancy, almost sterile way of saying they had a human zoo. And so they had Pacific Island villagers in loincloths on display, and they were advertised as the mysterious dog eaters. And so they were walking around making fires and carrying spears, and you would pay money to go in and gawk at these humans for their otherness. And they had the same thing with Inuit people, Eskimos. I think it was someone, it was probably just a carny, but someone posed as an Egyptian princess. You know, she was probably from New Jersey or someplace like that. But that kind of stuff I was always drawn to, and I think that had been done for decades.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Jamie Ford about historical and personal elements relating to his novel, Love and Other Consolation Prizes. We'll begin by discussing the nonfiction elements of the book, including a young boy who was raffled off at the World's Fair in Seattle. This program contains adult themes. Listener discretion is advised. How did you come to learn about the Alaska-Yukon Pacific Exposition?
The AYP. I just shortened it to the AYP. It's easier. You know, everyone in Seattle, growing up in Seattle, you have an institutional memory of the 62 World's Fair. I mean, it was before I was born, but the shadow of that fair looms large over everything. As a sixth grader, we all went to the fairgrounds and on a field trip, and I went to the Science Center. And so I was a bit surprised to learn that they had an earlier World's Fair, and it came from just finding old postcards of old Seattle. And I recognized what was then the University of Washington at the time was also the physical footprint for the AYP. And they built these giant buildings that were really facades of these magnificent, you know, almost Roman architecture type buildings, but they really didn't survive much longer than in the existence of the fair. They tore them all down except for two or three buildings.
Yeah. And I was looking up some of the promotional pieces for that. And that's one of the taglines was Seattle, the gateway to Alaska and the Orient.
Yeah.
Was that the purpose of the AYP?
Yeah. I think it was Seattle's coming out party as a city. I mean, it was a city that was trying to shed its frontier heritage, you know, of a timber city, of a frontier city where, you know, we had finished conquering the greater part of North America. And it was trying to put the city on par with, you know, San Francisco and the great cities on the east and Chicago. I think there was a certain audacity to having a World's Fair in a town like Seattle, which still really was rough around the edges. You know, it had a vibrant red light district that was supported by its mayor and police chief. And it wasn't far removed from the gold rush era.
And I can't wait to linger in the red light district, which is the setting for most of the book. But one of the things I learned through your book, I did a little bit of extra research, and there was a month-old boy who was raffled off at the AYP. Will you just give us a little bit of where this book takes place and this boy's story in your book?
Yeah, the book really began as just a personal rabbit hole moment. You know, we all have those moments where we go on the internet or go on Wikipedia and we go look up something, and then 3 hours later we've gone down some other tangent. And for me, I was researching the World's Fair, the AYP, and I kept stumbling across this mention of a boy named Ernest who was raffled off as a prize. He was donated by the Washington Children's Receiving Home. And I didn't initially want to write a book. I just wanted to know what the heck happened to this kid. Like, what was that all about? And I really couldn't find any satisfying answers. I later was aware that a museum in Seattle, a history museum, in 2009, which was the 100th anniversary of the AYP, they hired a lawyer to try and find out what happened to this boy. And she really hit a dead end, that the records were all destroyed in the 30s, and there really is no evidence of where he ended up, or even if anybody actually claimed him. That was still a bit of a mystery.
So you wrote the story of this boy, changed some details, his age, namely. Can you tell us a little bit of the backstory before we encounter Ernest at the World's Fair? Where did he come from?
You know, in my story, I've aged him up to the age of 12 because I wanted a point of view character that was a set of eyes that could look around the World's Fair and have a recollection. And if he was a toddler, he wouldn't. And so I needed that for, you know, as a narrative device. But also at that time, just for related to my own family, this is a decade or so after the Chinese Exclusion Act, which restricted Chinese workers from coming to this country. And yet many people in my own family still came to this country during that time period. And I was always curious as to how and why. And basically they were smuggled in. They were smuggled in from Canada. People still wanted to hire them. There was still a need for immigrant workers. And so they were basically trafficked in. Women were often brought to this country for nefarious purposes. Men were brought as and sold, both the men and women sold as indentured servants. And this is, you know, decades after the Emancipation Proclamation. But people were still bought and sold in the basements of buildings in the Northwest in the late 1800s and early 1900s. It was a fairly common practice that didn't end until after World War I, when the League of Nations addressed it and tried to put a stop to it.
You describe this scene when Ernest in China and other children are walking in the direction of a ship that will bring them to America. And this is the line that you wrote. A tributary of sadness flowing into a greater stream of refugees that became a flood of humanity, traveling away from the sound of thunder in a cloudless sky. When I read that, and just reading it now, I get chills. There's something that feels very relevant and present about that sentiment.
Yeah, my great-grandfather came to this country when he was 13 years old, and he came by himself. And I look at that generation of people, and they didn't come here necessarily because they were seeking fortune. They didn't come here to take the job of someone else. They came here because they wanted to live, to see the next sunrise. And in a time of famine, you know, made more complicated by all kinds of warring factions, people sold their children or gifted their children the opportunity to come to this country as they went off to die. And so, you know, there's definitely a parallel where we look at our own society and we see people coming from Syria or some other war-torn region of the earth, and they're not coming here with rapacious reasons to come and infiltrate our society. It was like people on boats after Vietnam. They were coming because they would die or they would be stuck in a refugee camp for a decade with no one coming to get them. And so I think, you know, that happenstance, we're only a generation removed and we're still looking at those people who are coming in desperate straits and we're seeing them as this strange threat. And I think that's more heartbreaking than the actual accounts of people dying.
That passage or the scene that I just read develops into a passage that I would ask you to read.
Sure. Yeah, this bit that I'm about to read, it's our main character, and he's a little more than a toddler, and his name is Jung. And when he comes to America, his name is later changed to Ernest Jung, but at this point, his name is Jung. And he has been sent to away from his village. His mother has passed away, and he's being sent to America. That night, Jung woke as the steam engine rumbled loudly along with his empty stomach. He sat up and realized that the other boys were snoring and that the oldest, a stout bully named Jun, had taken many of the blankets, including Jung's, for himself. The cargo hold was cold now, and he clutched his knapsack on his small corner of the shared mattress. And as the ship rocked and swayed on the open sea, he realized that with each minute, each hour, he was being carried farther from his village, away from his mother, forever. He wiped his eyes, and in the glow of a single wall-mounted lamp, Jung could see that some of the girls across from him were awake, staring back. They whispered among themselves and then lifted a corner of the blanket they were sharing. "Little brother," one of the girls motioned, "come over here." Jung glanced at his sleeping bunkmates, then he stepped lightly, nervously, with bare feet on the cool wooden floor. He hesitated, worried that this might be some kind of cruel joke. Then one of the girls reached up, tugging his sleeve, and pulled him beneath the covers. They made room as he nestled among them. He felt cold feet next to his, hands and arms, as they patted his chest and shoulders. "It's okay," a girl spoke in a small voice. "You're one of us." Jung looked at the girls. "What do you mean?" The girl in the blue robe sat up partway and peeked over at him, as if the answer were obvious. She spoke Chinese with a thick accent. "Nobody wants us either." Jung swallowed the bitter medicine of truth. He nodded, closed his eyes, and felt the tickling of their hair on his cheeks, on his neck, as they all settled in beneath the covers. Despite the sharing of the wash bucket, their clothing smelled old and musty, like his, reeking of weeks of smoke and dust. Jung didn't mind, nor did he care what the other boys would think in the morning. He was used to people staring at him on the street, the villagers who spat at him or laughed. But for now, he felt safely surrounded, comforted, as he drew a deep breath and melted into the girl's kindness.
Jamie, it seems like you like to position two emotions against each other. In this case, exile and kindness. What do you know about that instinct?
Oh, I like things in opposition. I think books that are all happy or unrealistic, and books that are all sad are a little too dreary or morose. And I think my characters and their circumstances are very much like the people you meet in everyday life. They're a confounding mix of good and bad, of happy moments and horrible things that have happened to them. But I think if we look at history, we have to look at both of those things. We can't look at, you know, the worst example is Gone with the Wind, where we look at a horrible situation and we see it through this rosy lens of, you know, slaves cheering as their masters go off to fight to keep them enslaved. And I think that's so cartoony, and it's a very insincere way to look at history. And so I try to look at history with all of its warts and flaws and also its moments of joy.
Which is interesting that you set this rather innocent love story in a brothel.
Yeah. Yes.
What can you tell us about the Tenderloin?
Yeah. I mean, part of it was just, you know, it was sort of upping the degree of difficulty where I wanted to write a very innocent coming of age love story, but I wanted it to be in a context where everyone is for sale, you know, a love that's all consuming in a environment that's all consummation. I think those two things rubbing against one another, no pun intended, is interesting. And I think in an environment where flesh is a commodity, emotion and sincerity are rare and treasured like diamonds. And so putting my characters in that environment is two things. One, it's a true place. The character of Madame Flora was a real madam. And so walking through that world is interesting for me as a researcher and as a writer, and hopefully for readers it's interesting, but it's also just a fun context to put these characters into and have them have their hearts on the line.
And Madame Flora is?
Yeah, Madame Flora was a very real person. I based much of her character on the previous madam in that same location, which was a madam named Lou Graham. And she was probably Seattle's most famous or legendary madam. And so I've sort of borrowed bits of her character for the story, but Madame Flora was a real woman as well. Her name was Florence Nettleton. I did a book event in Seattle a couple of weeks ago, and a gentleman, he was 85 years old, he waited to the end of my signing line, and he came up to me and he said, "I knew Florence Nettleton." And I was blown away. I'm just like, "Oh, sit down. Let's have a talk." And he brought me pages and pages, handwritten, of his recollections.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to a conversation with Jamie Ford about his novel, Love and Other Consolation Prizes. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. In the next segment, we'll get personal about abandonment issues and loving two people at the same time. Don't go away.
A love triangle develops in Ernest's young life. And what I found fascinating is it presents as a rather workable scenario that a young boy could have two loves and there wouldn't be total catastrophe.
Yeah.
So is this, my question is this every man's dream?
Is this every man's dream?
To fall for two women at once?
I don't know if it's every man's dream. It's probably every man's reality at some point in his life. I think the heart is a muscle that's always in perpetual conflict. And whether that's, you know, a person or, you know, a job, or I love my job, but I want to go here, or I love this hobby, but I also want to do this, or I, you know, perhaps a young boy in high school loves baseball, but he also wants to play football. We have moments where our hearts are torn in two different directions. But I do think it is possible to love two people equally. And there's no vanity in that. You just, if they're both sensational, important people to you. I say this as a young boy who once had a crush on a set of twins. So I know how this goes. It did not work out in my favor, but I know how that feels.
For what is love a consolation prize?
Wow. For what is love a consolation prize? you know, for some people, love is this all-consuming madness. And for other people, it's perhaps something shallow and trivial and maybe history with someone and years spent together, that companionship is much more resonant. And so if you look at the, you know, the construct of love, you can probably parse it a couple of different ways. In my story, it's really a mother's love for her child, and she sacrifices herself to send Ernest to this country. And that's, you know, for much of the story, that's the lingering ghost, that's the greater love. And then he ends up in a brothel where this artificial love is thrown about with currency. And for him, the real consolation prize is the friendships he has with people that are sincere and based on things other than physicality.
I want to hang with that maternal piece for a second.
Sure.
Is abandonment a theme in your work?
Yeah. that's the joke I have with my with my wife. Because I always say that if I ever had a bottle of cologne, my own line of cologne, it would be a cracked bottle and it would be called Abandonment.
What would it smell like?
Yeah, it would probably smell like, you know, like the flowers at the, of a funeral arrangement or something like that. It'd be something very sad. You know, my second book, Songs of Willow Frost, was dedicated to my mom, who I was super close to, but I lost too early. And even as a devoted mother, she had some profound flaws. And so to say that I have abandonment issues is like an understatement of the century. So I think a lot of what I write about are people searching for their place in the world when the guardrails and the training wheels have been kicked off.
A sense of belonging.
Totally.
Speaking of sense, another sentence that you write, which I found beautiful. He could always remember how she smelled, though. Sweet, like fresh watermelon, mangoes, and bayberries. While reading a science book years later, he learned that's what a body smells like when it's starving. That's Ernest reflecting on his mom.
Yeah. And it's really, I think we will look back on our parents through an evolving lens. And in Ernest's childhood, his mother is this fragrant, sweet person. And later in life, he does come to an understanding that that's because of the dire circumstances they were in and the circumstances that led him to come to America. And I think that's typical of our relationship with our parents. You know, as children, it's Christmas and Santa and puppies. And then as adults, as we appreciate what they went through, our perspective changes and we have a grown-up reckoning. And for some people, that's good. For some people, that's very traumatic. I think in my life, it's been both.
Those dual emotions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is this what you call the logical madness of parenting, where the tragic decisions are made with the best intentions?
Yeah. I mean, the logical madness of parenting as a parent that smokes two packs a day and tells his kids not to smoke. I mean, we see it all the time of not wanting our children to repeat patterns of behavior. And those intentions are always done with love, which is even more confounding.
I've also heard in an interview you gave with Goodreads that you have said, I think my brain must be hardwired for love stories. Mm. Jamie, why do we need love stories?
Wow. I think in the abstract, it's part of our biology. I think that's unavoidable. But I think, especially now where everything is commodified and so relationships are tender now. It's, you know, swipe left, swipe right. Everything's very shallow and superficial. And I think love stories are more important now when relationships are casual, is not the term, because, you know, people can be quite happy with casual, but lacking depth or substance, or, you know, people being reduced to, you know, their Twitter avatar. I think that real connectivity, it's not just important, it's missing in a lot of our lives. And so I like writing about those things because it's always kind of a, you would think that we have told Romeo and Juliet a million times, and even before Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, that was an archetype that he borrowed, but the framework of society around it keeps changing, so those stories always seem to resonate anew.
One of the things that really struck me when I read your book, Jamie, is, you know, there are these two young women in Ernest's life, and he ends up with one of them, but that is kept a mystery till nearly the end.
Yeah.
But the qualities of the love aren't these superficial, vain qualities of modern times, right? It's about dedication and responsibility and accountability and friendship and, you know, history even. What do you think the landscape of modern love stories is, and what do you think it needs to become more classic?
Mm. I mean, the landscape of modern love stories as far as in our culture?
Yeah,
or,
like...
Wow. I think there's really... There's some magical moments, and maybe they're magical because so much of our entertainment culture is special effects driven. It's, you know, robots smashing into other robots. And so we're just kind of benumbed by stories like that. And then when a story perhaps like La La Land, which is a riff on a classic musical, but with this heartbreaking love story at, you know, the center of that universe, it's so affecting and so moving. And so, for me anyway, I mean, I loved that movie and I thought it was so powerfully done. I think love stories still have a place in our culture. I think even though, you know, the internet has made our personal connections somewhat shallow and trivial, I think that only makes the real connections more powerful, you know, in the aggregate, I guess.
This book also addresses memory.
Yeah.
It flips back and forth between the 60s and the early 20th century. And I'm wondering if you would just be willing to read a little snippet about memory.
Sure. Yeah, this is a bit from the first chapter of the book. And Ernest is a man in his 60s. He doesn't know his exact birthday because he doesn't have a birth certificate. And he is a driver. He's a chauffeur, and he's shuttling people back and forth from the Century 21 Expo, which is Seattle's grand World's Fair with the Space Needle, and Elvis came and filmed a movie there. And he's on the outside looking in and having to reflect and reconcile his own memories of that first World's Fair. As Ernest is standing outside of the gates of the World's Fair, he notices a line of cherry trees, and these are trees that were removed from his childhood neighborhood and planted at the grounds of the World's Fair. And it pauses him, and he has to sort of reflect on a moment. As a young man, Ernest had carved his initials onto one of those trees, along with Gracie's, and those of another girl, too. He hadn't seen her in forever. As an aerialist rode a motorcycle on a taut cable stretched from the stadium to the Space Needle, Ernest listened to the whooshing and mechanical thrumming of carnival rides. He caught the aroma of freshly spun cotton candy, still warm, and remembered the sticky sweet magic of candied apples. He felt a pressing wave of deja vu. The present is merely the past reassembled, Ernest mused as he pictured the two girls and how he'd once strolled with them arm in arm on the finely manicured grounds of the World's Fair. The Great Alaska Yukon Pacific Exposition, back in 1909, when the city first dressed up and turned its best side to the cameras of the world. He remembered a perfect day when he fell in love with both girls. But as Ernest walked to the gate and leaned on the cold metal bars, he also smelled smoke. He heard fussy children crying, and as his ears were still ringing with the echoes of the celebratory cannons that had scared the birds away, he drew a deep breath. Memories are narcotic, he thought, like the array of pill bottles that sit cluttered on my nightstand. Each dose, carefully administered, use as directed. Too much and they become dangerous. Too much and they'll stop your heart.
This line, memories are narcotic, Jamie. Do you have a narcotic memory?
Do I have a narcotic memory? Yeah, I have several. You know, my mom passed away. I carried her body down a set of stairs to the man with the black limo that comes and zipped her into a bag. I have those memories, but I also have really tender memories of, I mentioned a set of twins earlier, of going to the school skating party as a sixth grader and just crushing on these two twins so horribly in the way that only a hopeless 12-year-old boy can crush on them, and then reconnecting with them later in life as we're, you know, in our late 40s and laughing about those times.
What was it like to see them again or talk to them again?
Joyfully mortifying.
Yeah.
You know, there's a whole other story there. Before this book came out, it's called Love and Other Consolation Prizes. It's about this love story. And I was asked to write a guest essay about love stories. And I wrote about that night at the skating rink. And that essay was published. And then it went out on the internet. And then they read it.
Yeah.
And they tracked me down. And it was just kind of like a sweet reunion. It was very funny.
Anything worthwhile is worth risking humiliation for, right?
Absolutely, yes. It was one of those things where I just sort of put my heart out there. And they were both tickled. It was pretty hilarious.
Jamie Ford lives in Great Falls, Montana. He's also the award-winning author of Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet and a die-hard romantic. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.